When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Robert?
Today, Russell, well, you know, I often feel global, and that's like something that I, you know, often joke about. Like, I'm so global. But today I'm actually feeling a bit more local, a bit more national, and a bit more British. And I've been thinking a lot about what it means to be British in this current moment, you know, post Queen Elizabeth. We're going into this kind of new era. But to learn about where we are in the current moment, you often have to look back to the past. And we are very lucky in the UK because we have lots of museums and institutions and archives and libraries. And today's guest is the head of one of these amazing institutions. It's a national treasure, if you like, the National Portrait Gallery. And it also, every time I think of the National Portrait Gallery, I always think of Snow White, weirdly. You know, imagine like looking into the mirror and being kind of like, you know, mirror, mirror on the wall. Because I am a bit of an evil queen.
Snow White.
You know what I am, hun.
Ursula.
No, but you know why? Because their collection at the National Portrait Gallery is so extraordinary. It has like over 220,000 works from the 8th century until the present day. And a lot of the people in their collection are kind of these figures from history. They've got like Elizabethan portraits, Tudor portraits, this, you know, works looking at the Civil War, Victorian, Edwardian, 20th century, contemporary portraits, even the portrait of Russell Tovey, which is just about to enter the collection. So we can talk about that very soon. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art a very fine gentleman, Nicholas Cullinan.
Thanks.
Hi, Nick.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Oh, thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Total pleasure. Total pleasure. So why are we talking to you, Nick, when we are talking about the National Portrait Gallery? What is your connection?
So, as you said, I work at the NPG. I've actually worked there twice thus far. So I worked there more than 20 years ago, which makes me feel really old, when I was a student. And it was a part-time job just to pay the bills. I worked there as a front-of-house visitor service assistant, like a guard, basically. And I loved it. And then I've been there the last 8 years as the director, overseeing this big project, which opens in just under a month, which is very exciting.
So exciting. So on the 22nd of June, 2023, the new National Portrait Gallery opens. And there's quite a few massive changes, including the actual entrance. So the way that you access the gallery is going to be completely new, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's many changes. And as you said, it's like top to bottom, Tudors to now. And it's from even before you set foot in the building. And one of the things that Jamie Forbert, the architect, who's been a pleasure to work with, very astutely noticed about the MPG is that our existing, previously, you know, our previous main entrance was more like a side entrance for a museum today, and that there was no real public presence or forecourt. And so he set about rectifying that. So we have this beautiful new forecourt that at last provides a proper welcome to the gallery.
Well, that sounds great. So let's go back to you being a student then. You studied at the Courtauld, which is one of the top history of art schools in the world. And you spent basically 7 years there doing your BA, MA, PhD. And then as a part-time job, you were at the MPG. Why was it the MPG that you chose to work at that age?
because they offered to pay me.
Well, that's actually really good.
It was good. I did all kinds of part-time jobs. I worked, the big one was Boots Opticians on Kensington High Street. I used to work there every Saturday and Sunday. And then it was the MPG Thursday and Friday evenings. So there was other part-time jobs too. But I always really enjoyed it. I used to love like leaving the library at the Courtauld, walking down the Strand, going to the gallery. I didn't love putting on my uniform because it was polyester and itchy and really kind of scratchy. But I used to love being in the gallery and spending time with the visitors, with the collection. Yeah, I just always had a real affection for the place and still do, which is nice after now two stints and 8 years this time around.
And as director of it, yeah, you should.
And I read that part of your role was to actually like walk around with people visiting and like talk about the works on display, you know, back then.
A bit. I mean, I used to do some tours and like talk about works, but to be honest, it was mostly like being in rooms and making sure that people didn't damage stuff.
Right.
But that meant that I just had a lot of time in the galleries and I had time to like read the labels and it was just funny because I never thought that job would be useful in the future, although I enjoyed it. And then when I had my interview like 9 years ago now to be director, when the trustees would show me a postcard and say, "What's this?" It was all there, and I could be like, "Oh, that's George Romney's self-portrait from 1784." Or it was just one of those weird things about life that you do one thing, you don't think it's going to lead anywhere, and then suddenly it does. So yeah,
that was your mastermind challenge.
Yeah.
So you are a high art achiever. So you are at the National Portrait Gallery now, but your CV for positions that you've been working at is the top of the top. It's like Hollywood A-list version of the art world. You've worked at MoMA, the Guggenheim, the Tate, the Met. Now you're at the National Portrait Gallery. How has this happened? And it looks from the outside very seamless and very much like you've just gone, like you work with Peggy Guggenheim's collection as a fellow, which I don't even know what that means as a fellow, but that's like sounds
not
great.
Not as a woman, as a fellow.
But it's like you've had the most incredible art career.
Yeah, it looks like that now, but like it didn't feel like that at the time. Like, I mean, as I said, you know, I studied and I had to work a lot of part-time jobs just to kind of get by and pay the bills like most students. And it was kind of like hand to mouth. I mean, literally, like I spent a lot of time living on very little money and also just not very clear like where my next rent check was coming from or what was going to, if I was going to get, you know, a scholarship to be able to go and do an MA after the BA. And then if I was going to be able to get a scholarship to do the PhD and then if I was going to get a job. So this is sounding like really maudlin and like bring out the violin.
It's inspiring.
Well, no, it's just because you can look at these things and people do say, I do like lots of talks in state secondary schools with this amazing charity called Speakers for Schools, which I love, about the art world and, you know, art history and things you can do in it. And, you know, teenagers say to me, "Oh, like, how do I get a career or a job like yours?" And I always say to them, like, you know, maybe now it looks seamless, but it wasn't at the time, and that I had lots of rejection and discouragement, and you just kind of have to keep going and believe in it and kind of hold your nerve a little bit. And yeah, and then gradually it kind of built up a bit of traction, which was nice. But for example, like the reason that I started out in New York was because with MoMA, I had the internship in the photography department. It's because they did a paid internship. This is back in 2005, 2006. And at that time, like British museums, the internships were unpaid and I couldn't afford to do an unpaid internship because I was studying and then I had to work to pay my rent. And so I kind of had to move to New York again, like poor me, but literally like I had to move to New York to be able to do, just to get some experience, but it had to pay me. I couldn't afford to do these things for free. And I'm really glad now that in British museums, all internships are paid. It's something that I feel really...
Oh, they are. Because there's a quote where you've said that unpaid internships are an abuse. And it feels like...
Well, I mean, it's not an abuse if you can afford to give your time. It's a lovely thing. I now can volunteer and do stuff like Speakers for Schools or other stuff, but I'm in a position where I can afford to volunteer. I wasn't in that position 15 years ago. Mm. And the thing that's really bad about that is it means that the people that begin to get experience and therefore get traction that I talked about and then become successful are people that can afford to do that. Mm. So it's kind of nepotism. It's really unfair. It like tilts the playing field in a really unfair way. And I just think that one of the really important things for the art world, it's getting better, but there's still a long way to go, is to be open to as many people and as many really good people as possible. And the wider and more diverse the pool of people that want to do it, the better it's going to be, rather than like a self-selected little elite. So yeah, something I feel quite strongly about.
Yeah, for sure. So what was it about art history specifically that spoke to you when you were growing up? Because I feel like you are an art historian, but you've also become a curator. So was it curating or was it art history that you sort of began with?
It was more sort of art history, and it was pretty random. I took a gap year, but not in the kind of like nice travel around Europe way. I took a year out between my A levels and then going to university, because I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, and I didn't want to kind of waste the opportunity and the amazing debt of going to university. So I took some time out, and I worked at Boots Opticians in Halifax, where I grew up before they transferred me to High Street Ken. And I worked, and then when I could afford, I traveled a little bit. I went to Venice, and that was like my kind of real epiphany. And I was in the Academia Gallery, and it used to be open late on a Wednesday evening. And I was there by myself on Wednesday with my rough guide. And I was in that, you know, that final room of Carpaccio's St. Ursula cycle, which I still love. This, you know, Renaissance narrative cycle around the life and the martyrdom of St. Ursula. And I was in this room by myself, and I was reading the guidebook, and it was talking about John Ruskin and how he became obsessed with his paintings, and in particular, The Dream of St. Ursula. And I just had this like little proper epiphany where I was like, I want to do art history. This is what I wanted to spend my life doing, because you get to look at these amazing visual objects. And in doing that, you need to bring in history, literature, languages, like all these different spheres of culture. And so I kind of came home and I researched like where the good places to do art history are. And I applied to a bunch of them. And one of them was the Courtauld. And it started from there. But yeah, it was random, really. But I mean, that's the other thing. I think the main piece of luck in life is to figure out what you want to do. And then there's like a big battle to be able to do it. But the first thing is like figuring out what you want to spend your life doing. That's the key thing.
But that's the hardest thing for so many people. I mean, yep. I feel a privilege that I knew as a kid, I want to be an actor. And that was it. And I just was blinkered. But if you don't, if you really genuinely don't know, it's a really bewildering, quite scary terrain ahead of you. And then if you suddenly get like, you do drift for a while and you suddenly get to like 30, then you're like, and you haven't really, still haven't planned it. It's really, it's terrifying.
Yeah, I just think the big piece of luck in life is to figure that out. And as you say, to figure it out early enough so that you can then, I mean, it's never too late, you know. No. And who knows, maybe we're all going to have an amazing second and third act. I hope we will. But it's great when you figure it out and, you know, at the right age, and then you can begin. And then, of course, it's super hard thereafter. But in a way, that's the hardest bit, is to kind of figure out, what do I love? What am I dedicated to?
You know, I always used to find it so pressurizing, that idea of trying to work out what it is you want to be. And I remember sitting in school when you'd have those kind of careers meetings.
Advice things.
And all I wanted to do was be a pop star. And it was such not a possibility. Do you know what I mean? And everyone was like, go to university, do this, do that. But recently I heard this podcast called On Being, and there was this poet on it. And he was talking about how people pay attention to things. And it suddenly, like, after all these years, made so much sense about so much stuff, the idea of just paying attention. And it's almost like if people had said to me back then, like, what would you like to pay attention to? It would have just been so much easier. It's almost like the language around it is this kind of like heavy weight of like,
what you're
going to
be
in the world.
Yeah,
what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, what job do you want to have? And I'd always be like, I have no idea. Because actually finding your vocation or whatever it is just about what you pay attention to, what you like to focus on.
What do you love? You know, that's the main thing. That's the other thing that I often say to students when I'm talking to them, is like, don't listen to anyone telling you, you know, what you should be. Just figure out what you love and do that.
Yeah.
Because if you do that, probably you'll become good at it, and then you'll probably become successful at it with a bit of luck. But like, just do what you love. Like, don't tune out all the other white noise of, you should be this, you should do this, you should do this because it pays well, blah, blah, blah. Like, just figure out what you love and do that. Same as attention, really.
Yeah.
Can you just go back to say who John Ruskin is and his connection to Venice? Because people listening might not know who he was.
Oh, you're testing me. So John Ruskin was a 19th century historian and writer, and he wrote about many different topics. Many of them were to do with art history, especially like the Gothic and Venice indeed. And he was also very socially kind of aware and advanced lots of kind of good socialist principles in the 19th century. And I guess his writing has been kind of forgotten about a little bit now. I mean, people still know the name, but I don't know how many people read his writing. Not that I spend like all my weekends under a tree with the collected works of John Ruskin. But he's a really fascinating figure, actually. And it's just a coincidence that that was... I'm not saying it was like John Ruskin that made me do this, but it was just being in that room with those paintings by Carpaccio. Yeah, like a little light bulb went off, and that was, I still think about that a lot, you know? And it's just nice that like 20 odd years later, that moment was still right, if that makes sense, thus far. Who knows, but yeah.
So in 2015, you were made director of the National Portrait Gallery, and you were just 37. That's crazy. And in 2020, it was announced that the National Portrait Gallery was going to be closed for 3 years for renovations. And it's, as we're saying in the opening, it's due to open very, very soon. Why did it need renovations? And why did it need to be shut down for so long for that?
Good question. Okay. So, yeah, when I was appointed 8 years ago, there was a kind of plan to do a transformation project. And it began kind of with a shopping list of different items. And one thing that was at the top of the list was that we had an amazing learning department. They did all kinds of incredible work with different groups and communities, and, you know, from young children to adult learners. But we had like one really not very particularly welcoming studio, which was a real shame. So there was a sense of we need a proper learning center to host these people and these activities. Also, it's just some really basic things, but like the building had stopped working properly. So because at that point we began using the entire ground floor for exhibitions, the lift, you couldn't get or get out of the lift on the ground floor because it would have dropped you off in the middle of a paid exhibition. So anyone with a wheelchair or a buggy, like A, no step-free access in, really embarrassing. You couldn't connect to the ground floor. There was all these issues, and that's just some kind of practical issues. The other thing is that, you know, a lot of the galleries hadn't been touched or rehung or even the labels looked at for like 30 years. And I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. Like some of those things were great, but, you know, some labels were just feeling a little clunky in terms of the way they talked about things, you know, and just a bit sort of old school and a bit maybe, yeah, just not as relevant, not as engaging. I mean, there was also things about the collection wanting to kind of, you know, grow and advance the collection and sort of to work with the best artists and the best sitters like Russell Tovey, Doran Langberg. We'll come on to that now.
We'll come on to that.
And yeah, so basically we began kind of formulating how you would transform a museum. And what I liked about it from the get-go was that it wasn't about just building a new wing, like grafting something new onto what was already there, something old, but it was about making the most of what was already there. The building, the collection, you know, the interpretation, but also, you know, we've done like a big rebrand and it's everything all at once together, which I think is really nice. And then just to sort of answer the second part of the question in terms of, so we began working on this from when I started, fundraising and then appointing Jamie. And then what we gradually came to realize, I think the original plan was that we could do this in kind of phases and shut one floor and then do that while we did the second floor. And we talked to everyone who had done a big sort of transformation, but especially people that had done a transformation in buildings that were similar to ours, like a grade one listed historic building. And also a building that doesn't have, I was going to say detachable wings, but that sounds weird. But like, you know, like a big building like the V&A where you could work in one wing and you wouldn't even know.
You wouldn't even know it, yeah.
Yeah, we're sort of like a palazzo and you if you're doing something upstairs or downstairs, you're going to hear, you're going to know. And what everyone said to us is, if you can close, close, because what's going to happen is you're going to start and you're going to have one floor open, and the disruption and the noise and the vibration and the dust is going to be so bad that your visitors will stop coming and they're going to complain. And also, and eventually you'll just have to shut anyway. And then the other thing we realized is that if we just sort of bit the bullet and close the gallery, it would be, we would save a year of time. It would have taken 4 years, not three. And we also saved like more than £1 million. And then the final thing I'll say is that, so that wasn't the plan originally, to close, but we realized it was kind of the right way to go. Also, just in terms of safeguarding the collection, you know, and scary things happened while we were working on the project, like the second fire at the Glasgow School of Art and Notre Dame burning down. And I was like, I kind of don't want to be the director that did a building project and like burned all the Tudor paintings or like the Chandos portrait of Shakespeare. Because this is like part of our national psyche. It would be a catastrophe. We were thinking about those things definitely.
Where did all the paintings go? I know that there was hundreds of works that went to collections, like touring collections around the nation, but is there a huge storage facility somewhere, or how did you protect them to safeguard all the actual works?
Yeah, they were mostly in my living room. No. So the other thing is, you know, we thought, okay, look, the building in London is going to be really compromised, and that's just what it is. Like, it needs to be redone. It, you know, museums exist over tens and hopefully hundreds of years, and every few decades they need work. It's just how it is. So let's, you know, bite the bullet, do that. And then what an amazing opportunity to actually take the collection outside of London and to tour it all around the country, share it around the world. So we did that, and we basically just shared the collection more widely than ever before. And we did all these fantastic programs around the UK with big exhibitions. For example, like all of our great Tudor paintings went to Liverpool and went to Bath, things that will never leave probably London in my lifetime again, just because they're very fragile. And, you know, we sort of need them on view because our visitors expect them. But being closed just gave us the chance to share everything, just to be super generous and not just focus on London, which I feel really passionate about, having grown up in Yorkshire. And we did other projects, like this great project we do called Coming Home, where we lend one portrait back to the place that's associated usually with the sitter or the artist. So, for example, we lent Tracy Emin to Margate, and the Bronte sisters back to the parsonage in Haworth, where I grew up. So we did that, and that's just had such an amazing response with kind of local communities. I mean, for example, we lent this portrait of Stormzy to the library in Croydon, and it had an amazing response, but also like it boosted attendance there by something, I think it was like 300%, something crazy. Wow. Like lending one thing can have such a massive
impact.
That's
what art does, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also
when
it
catches like that, it really can change lives.
And it's kind of also a unique USP about our collection, which is, you know, the people on our walls are people from all four corners of the country, and they all have different stories to tell. But if you lend that portrait back to Haworth or Croydon or Margate, it makes people in those communities think, oh, this person has done that, and they've achieved something, and they're part of a bigger national story, and maybe they even have kind of world significance. It just breaks down these boundaries that have been kind of cropping up between, you know, local, national, international. So, yeah, we just did things like that, and it just felt really positive.
Looking forward, if you think about, you actually mentioned the idea of like the psyche of the nation and the kind of like the way we all consider ourselves to be British. Has there been a kind of reanalysis about what the National Portrait Gallery's role is in, you know, today's world, in a much more kind of inclusive world, hopefully, particularly in the UK?
Yeah, it's a really good point. Yeah, we did a lot of thinking about that, and you know, a lot of the project was like going back through our history and our archive. I mean, for example, like the new logo comes from this incredible little sketch we found in the archive by the first director of the MPG, Sir George Scarfe, who was a much better draftsman than I can barely write these days. But he made these beautiful drawings and studies. He sort of traveled the UK and made it essentially kind of an inventory of portraits in all these different country houses, and like a national collection. And he did this in 1893, just before our building opened in 1896. He did this beautiful logo of this interlocking MPG. And we took that as the kind of DNA of our new logo, because in a way it felt like a nice visual metaphor for what we were doing, which was to make ourselves hopefully more relevant, definitely more inclusive and more engaging, and in a way to feel more contemporary, but to do that by looking back through our past and understanding how and why we began. And, you know, I mentioned John Ruskin and the 19th century, and we're a 19th century, in a good and a bad way, institution. I'll talk a little bit more about that. But really kind of going back through our origins, you know, why we were founded, what it meant then, what's changed, you know, what should change, what should stay the same, what's relevant now, what's less relevant, what needs to be rethought or critiqued or reexamined. And I mean, it's interesting because in some ways, just going back, so we were founded in 1856, and when we were founded, we were the first portrait gallery in the world. And it's quite a weird thing to have a portrait gallery. Mm. Not that many countries still have them. It's quite an Anglo-Saxon phenomenon. There's one obviously here, there's one in Edinburgh, there's one in Washington in America, there's one in Canberra in Australia. So they're relatively few. But when we were founded to, it's kind of interesting. I don't want to get sort of too bogged down in the detail, but we were kind of founded in opposition to the kind of grand telling of history that this was what was discussed in the kind of 1850s when we were being founded, against the kind of grand history you get in those large paintings at Versailles, for example, outside Paris, where it's this kind of epic telling of French history. And what was decided was perhaps more British is this history of individuals and a more intimate and maybe a slightly more humble kind of tapestry of piecing together a national story through all these different lives, which I think is still a very nice idea. And even then, when we were founded, the idea was that we would be, there was this kind of Victorian aspect that we were there so that people, you know, ordinary working people would have something to aspire to and to emulate. But what was also interesting is that it was decided that it shouldn't just be the great and the good, that we should acquire portraits of people that were flawed, because that was part of the story and people would learn from that. And that's still, I think, very relevant, that we're, you know, hopefully we're not there just to provide these examples of people to say, you know, you should emulate this person like Russell Tovey. We're there to provide this account. It's very sort of, you know, interesting, nuanced debate around identity and, you know, how people can have an impact, and also how people, you know, can be flawed, unlike Russell Tovey.
Unlike me, I'm not flawed. But it's an impartial collection, isn't it then? You can't, it's not political. You know, we'll have portraits of Margaret Thatcher, for example, who is a polarizing figure, but important and historical. So of course she's in there, but then there will be people to be like, we shouldn't have that. And other people will be like, yes, we should have that.
Well, it's interesting. So when I started in 2015, the big word that was used as a criteria for acquiring someone, and I should say that when we acquire a portrait, it's always the sitter first that we look at, and then
I love that guiding principle. Yeah, just to clarify that, this the subject before the artist, which goes against everything in you know, every other institution is always artist first and then whatever it is, but this is always the sitter is the most important hierarchy, then comes the artist.
Yeah, I mean, and we did that maybe almost to a fault sometimes, in that I think sometimes we would focus so much on the sitter that the artist became kind of not irrelevant, but it was perhaps less important. And one thing I was very keen to do was to, especially when we commission, which we do, was to really get this perfect marriage of artist and sitter. And so, for example, when I was interviewed, they said to me, if you could commission a portrait of any sitter by any artist, what would it be? And I said, it would be a portrait of Malala by Shirin Nashat. And that was sort of deliberate on a couple of levels, in that, you know, Malala is such an amazing and inspiring world figure, you know, not born in the UK, but obviously has been based here for many years in Birmingham and then Oxford. And then the second thing I wanted to do was to sort of think, it doesn't have to be a British figurative painter to make that image. Like, it could be, it's the best artist, like, go and find them. Just in the way that, you know, we have Van Dyck and we have Holbein and many other artists who weren't born in the UK but have worked here, or, you know, have made an extraordinary image of someone from here. And so choosing Shirin was a very sort of deliberate move too. And so when I began, we progressed that commission. And I had no idea when I asked Malala if she would like to be depicted by Shirin, and when I asked Shirin if she would like to depict Malala, if they would both agree and sort of be happy. And they were absolutely delighted. And that image is just such an amazing, powerful image still. I'm really proud of. So yeah, we really sort of wanted to think about how to kind of grow the collection too. And now, sorry, I've lost my trail of thought, but
no, I mean you've covered lots there. I love this idea of the commission, and I love this idea that you've paired the artist and the sitter there. When it comes to commissions, is that something that you actively with trustees pitch? Do you pitch like, we need this sitter, I really want to pair this together? Is this something that comes from people who are making donations and they go, I want to donate an image like this with this person? How does that process work?
Yeah, it's both. So the commissions, which is a very unique thing to the MPG, like I think we're the only institution that actually commissions for its collection. Every year we commission a handful of portraits. And how that works is that the trustees sit down and they look at, we prepare for them a list of people across always different disciplines. So it's always balanced. It's people that are in the arts, in sciences, in politics, maybe less so recently, in all these different fields. And the trustees kind of in a discussion come up with like a handful, like six or so sitters that they want to prioritize as commissioning. And we then take that list and then sort of match make with the artist and find the artist to take on that commission. So another example is Nick Sirota was long down as a commission, and the right artist hadn't been found. And again, when I started, that sort of wasn't really progressing. And I had lunch with Nick, and I said, and you know, there was an idea for a certain artist, I'm not going to say who it was, but it felt very expected. And I said, you know, I'm not sure this really kind of does you favors, and I'd like more of a curveball for you, and like an artist that you've always worked with but maybe isn't as obvious. And how about Steve McQueen? And right away Nick was like, oh yeah, that would be really interesting. And then we approached Steve, and he was like, I would love to do a portrait of Nick, because you know, Nick is someone that Steve has known, worked with since.
And who is Nick Sirota for people?
Oh, sorry. Nick Sirota is, that feels like a t-shirt waiting to happen. Nick Sirota, is best known as being the former director of the Tate Gallery. And he was the director for, God, more than 20 years, 25 years, like began in the late 80s and finished in 2016. I used to work with him. That's not why we commissioned a portrait of him. But he basically oversaw the creation of Tate Modern. And in doing that, I think was one of the kind of key figures that put London and contemporary art in London much more on the map.
So where does the funding come from for commissions then? Is that again like donations, or is that something that the MPG has reserves for?
No reserves? Well, yeah, we have a little bit of money. But the other thing that we've done a lot the last 8 years now is to really endlessly fundraise. And so when I started like 8 years ago, this project was going to be by far, it was meant to be 35 million, and it was going to be by far the biggest project that we'd ever done, the biggest amount we'd ever fundraised. And there was lots of kind of, I would say, uncertainty both within the building and maybe outside about, could we raise that money and would we do it? And we've, I've got amazing colleagues in the development team, and we just sort of figure out how to make things possible. So in the end, I feel like I'm boasting now, but I'm going to boast for a second. Cool. Yeah. So in the end, we basically didn't just raise that money. We actually over fundraised by like 10 million. So we raised about 45 million for the capital campaign. And then we've just acquired the most, this is boring to talk about money, but we've just acquired, you know, this very expensive painting. But this incredible painting by Reynolds, Portrait of Mai, who was a Polynesian visitor to Georgian London, who had a big impact. And that painting, since it was first shown at the Royal Academy in 1776, has always been seen as one of the great British portraits, probably Reynolds' greatest work. And so we've just acquired that. And that was an epic fundraising sort of battle. Yeah, like everything we do, we pretty much have to fundraise for. And it's a lot of work, but it's just, you know, money's not that interesting. I think what's interesting is to have an idea and think, right, let's make this possible. And it doesn't have to be a huge amount of money. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about a 50 million pound painting or something that doesn't cost that much. It's the idea that's important.
But also, like, somewhere like the National Portrait Gallery has such power to kind of tell stories and tell stories of, you know, kind of actual living experience in a way.
Yeah.
And I feel like, has that had to have been, like, in your rehang, are you having to sort of try and seek out stories that might not have been represented previously? Like, have you discovered some amazing, like, women that might have been left out of history before? You know, if you think of even the stuff that Katie Hessel's been doing recently with, you know, her book and podcast, like, kind of rediscovering voices that might have been in the collection but wouldn't have been on display.
Absolutely. And there was many gaps in the collection. And you know, the thing I should say is that this project didn't begin because we decided on a whim to do, like, a big transformation project. It really began by talking to and listening to both our visitors and people that didn't visit and understanding why.
Right.
Yeah, it was really interesting. That's what kind of began the project, was like really talking to people and seeing what they thought of the MPG and what worked and what didn't work. And that.
But what was the main thing then? Why were people saying they weren't visiting?
So the main reason that was given for people that didn't visit was that it was irrelevant. It was kind of an old, dusty institution full of portraits of old white men. That was the perception,
right?
And there was a degree of truth to that in terms of you know, the collection was skewed in a way. It definitely didn't represent the British population now, let's say. So one thing that we've also been doing in a very rigorous way the last few years is to really, yeah, as I said, like really build the collection, and that takes many forms. So, for example, we've been working really hard, to your point about, you know, Katie's work, which is fantastic. We've been working really hard to get much better gender balance. And we've done this big project supported by Chanel, which has been amazing. They funded us for 3 years to make acquisitions, but also funded curatorial posts.
Wow.
My amazing colleague Flavia, who's been leading this, and research so that we could make acquisitions, but also, you know, to your point, that we could go through our archive and figure out what we already had, and like no one had the bandwidth or time to look at. And the output of that, when you come and see the gallery, is, you know, post 1900, we've gone from 23% of the sitters on the wall being women to 48%. We've more than doubled it, and we've almost got gender parity, which is fantastic.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The other thing is that, we've tried really hard to fill in gaps, to fill in sitters that we're missing. And that's why, for example, the portrait of Mai is just such an amazing, powerful thing to have this, you know, one of the greatest British portraits and works of art, but also of a non-white sitter in Georgian London who was given dignity, both in that painting and pretty much generally in terms of his reception, and wasn't here in any way because he was subjugated or part of slavery or any of those other narratives, that we also really engage with in a very honest way, which I think is really important. But that just is such a powerful story of kind of transcendence. And that's something, you know, we've also worked with amazing advisory groups the last few years to kind of give us different perspectives. And we had a fantastic advisory group to advise on slavery and colonialism. And one thing they said to us very clearly, both that group and other people that we spoke to, is, you know, it's really important to tell the history, the very honest history, painful history of slavery in this country, but that's not enough. And it's not acceptable, you know, to kind of only have a history which shows slavery and then Windrush and then now, we need to be given other examples of kind of, you know, transcendence and agency. So hence people like Mai, for example, you know, we don't have a portrait of him, but we've borrowed Elizabeth Peyton's beautiful portrait of Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, who was American, but spent several years in the UK. There's an amazing film about him right now in Isaac Julian's retrospective at Tate Britain. And so we began thinking about how we could fill these gaps too by working with great artists to show sitters that, you know, we can't acquire an image because one doesn't exist or one's not available, but to kind of in a way backfill. And it, hopefully it just adds up to a much richer, more engaging, more representative account of Britain and its history. One that's truer as well. It's, you know, it's actually, it resembles what Britain was and is like now rather than one particular slice.
Maybe it also allows for more to grow as well from that. Like, I think it's a richer bed, isn't it, in a sense? Like,
yeah,
more fertile ground.
And hopefully it will also encourage people that haven't been to the MPG or haven't been for a long time to start coming and to start thinking about these things and to engaging. And, you know, it could trigger a whole other wave of change, which would be fantastic.
So do you think as a tourist, a visit to the MPG helps you to understand Britain more?
Ooh, that's needed, isn't it? Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of our remits, one of our roles, right? I mean, I would hope that just on a very basic level that, you know, when you as an international visitor, when you come to London, we might be in that sort of list of five or so museums that you need to go see to understand this country, you know, and that hopefully like going to the BM, the National Gallery, Tate, the B&A, hopefully we would be amongst those museums. And yeah, I mean, and we have a very unique particular role, you know, we're about, because it's a really interesting institution. It's obviously about art, but also it's about history and biography and the marriage of those things, which is unique.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to segue on to, we've hinted at it, so we may as well just let the elephant out of the room. The portrait that is of me, the centre in the collection, which is very exciting. But you just mentioned Elizabeth Peyton, and I know there's a portrait that's on your Instagram that Elizabeth painted of you in 2018, where you're there very comfortably in a pair of short shorts reading a book. And I was hoping that this would be in the collection, but this is actually in the collection of Tadeusz Ropak. So I don't even know if it's got to be part of the MPG collection.
No,
but
no.
You've been painted by Elizabeth because she's your friend a few times. Huh? And I'd like to talk about your process of that, but then we can segue onto me being painted by Daron Langberg, who's a friend of mine. That was the first time we'd worked together on that, but it'd be really interesting to hear your process of being painted by someone like Elizabeth Peyton.
Okay, my process is that I fall asleep. So for that portrait in 2018, I've known Elizabeth a long time, but we became friendly when I was living in New York before I came back to the MPG, and I was working at the Met, and I was working on a show there about unfinished works of art, and I included this incredible work of hers, which is a finished painting after an unfinished David portrait of Napoleon. And Napoleon's been a really important figure for Elizabeth. She read this biography of him when she was young that kind of changed her life. So we became friendly then, and she asked me to sit for a portrait, and we did that. And I guess it's really, I mean, I'm curious to know what you think, but it's really interesting sitting for a painted portrait. It's different than a photograph in many ways. But what I've realized is like it's really about the sense of kind of trust and intimacy between the artist and the sitter. It's so important. And I think in the early, and also as a sitter, like you really want it to work for the artist because you don't want to waste their time. So there's this kind of pressure. And I think in the early sittings, we didn't know each other as well. And maybe it was a bit stiff and it didn't quite work. And by the time we got to that, the one that did work in 2018, she was working on a show and she had a deadline. And I was like, this one's got to work. So I basically fell asleep during the sitting because I was really tired. And that worked a charm because I wasn't posing or self-conscious or like there's just nothing about me. I mean, I was awake for the first bit. So that's when my eyes were open. And then I kind of kept nodding off. So that's what I found to be, that's what worked for me, I guess. But I'm just curious to hear how it was for you. But I feel it's definitely contingent on that sense of trust.
Yeah, it's a kind of, it's a transaction in some ways, like a an art transaction, and there is definitely a vibration. I understand that feeling of wanting to be your best for them so that they feel satisfied, and you suddenly feel like, even though you are neutral to an extent, it is performative. You are giving something and you're holding a stillness, or you're holding a thing. But I'm such a huge fan of Deron Langberg, and I was working in New York last year. He's just the best. And yeah, there's a great podcast that you did with him on the Freeze. What is the podcast called? It's just Freeze Masters podcast. Yeah, which is an incredible conversation you had. But I was working last year in New York, and we'd always talked about it. We've known him for many years. He's been on Talk Art. And he was like, I'm going to paint you at some point. And I spent a lot of time in Fire Island, which is very important to Deron. I saw him out there. And then he was like, look, I'm in the studio in Brooklyn. Why don't you come along and do a painting? And I was like, yeah, let's do it. This just sounds incredible. And I had a moustache at the time because I was playing like this 80s New York cop. And I thought, well, I want a permanent record of that because I was very proud of my tash. And then just sort of sat there with him, and it was wonderful. And I know his work really well. And then to see yourself within someone's practice who you love and you're a fan of is such a privilege. And then I think you'd spoken to him before about, obviously, for the podcast that you two did together. And then I speak to his gallery and everything, and I was like, it'd be amazing if this got into like a museum somewhere. And then the MPG come up, and here we are, and it's now going to be in the collection, which is just like it blows my mind that not only am I going to be in the MPG, but also the fact that it's painted by someone who I absolutely love. There's a real connection.
Yeah. I mean, no, it's such a great portrait, and we're thrilled. And, obviously to represent you as someone who's very prominent in British life, but to do that through a great artist, and again, to kind of bring Deron into the collection, it's that sense of matchmaking, which we just love doing. So we're really thrilled, and it will be on view when we reopen in less than a month. Very exciting.
And also, I like the fact that he's an international artist too. I think that's really interesting about the MPG, because like so much of British culture is about connecting to other cultures and to, you know, different countries around the world. And I like that kind of outward looking thing. And
I just feel, you know, I mean, look, I was born in America, but I grew up here, and I've lived a couple of times in America for work. And, you know, I feel basically British, and I always choose to live here because I love this country, but I wasn't born here. And I think that's the case for lots of people that, you know, have moved here or have always lived here and were born here, but have spent time abroad or whatever. I think it's a bit more porous than that. And I think definitely, you know, I don't think we should just become like a repository for like British figurative painting. And I love British figurative painting, but we shouldn't just be only that. And that's why, you know, I've just really strived hard to kind of just to always work with the best artist for the whichever commission or sitting or portrait, and just to, in a way, not worry about like what someone's passport is.
What is the process then? So that painting you would have come across that painting, the Gallery Victoria Miro would have said to you, who represent Deron, would have said, look, there's this painting, we really want to get it into the collection. What is then the process going forwards? How many people have to approve it? Does it have to go to trustees?
Oh, yeah, all that stuff. So it goes to our curatorial committee. So that's the entire curatorial department, and they discuss it. And then if it's recommended to go to trustees, it goes to our trustees, and they discuss it. So it's like a two-step process. There is no shortage of bureaucracy in museums, don't worry. It's just exciting to kind of make these things happen. So, and you know, when we reopen next month, we've got like more than 60 works that haven't been seen before the collection as commissions or acquisitions. And that's gonna, you know, all together with, again, like for example, having, you know, doubled our representation of women post 1900, I keep having to say that because it's harder pre 1900, but we're working on it. It just feels very different. It feels really exciting, and I think the quality, the diversity has definitely gone up, but the quality has gone up, and I think both those things are important.
Can you reveal any names yet, or is it all still secret?
Oh yeah, like lots of them are already out there. This amazing Michael Armitage portrait that he did in 2020 of key workers that he donated, which is going on view. The one of Nick Sirota by Steve McQueen that I mentioned. There's this wonderful one of Michael Eavis, the founder of Glastonbury, by Peter Blake, that we actually unveiled at Glastonbury last year.
Oh.
There's Toyin Oju Odutola's amazing portrait of Zadie Smith that we haven't shown.
Mm.
That's toured though, hasn't it, that one? I think.
Love that painting.
It's amazing. Yeah, it was shown at Brent in when it was the Borough of Culture, but it has, you know, it's the first time that we'll be showing it, and it's an amazing portrait. Obviously, like the portrait of Mai by Reynolds, an amazing Gainsborough that we acquired. There's so many loads. So yeah, it's really exciting to be able to kind of finally show all these things and to show that how, you know, cumulatively they've just begun to shift the dial.
Do you feel in competition with other museums and institutions?
No, not at all. Like, I mean, we're colleagues. We all kind of work together. In fact, actually, I was just, I swung by Tate Britain on the way here. So I'm speaking to you from my flat in Oval in South London. And walking back from the MPG, I sort of swung by Tate Britain. I'll be back there tomorrow for their summer party. And I was looking at their rehang, which I really enjoyed. Now, I don't feel in competition. I mean, I'm just not competitive. Like, I've never been competitive as an individual. I'm very driven in terms of what I do. Like, whatever I'm doing, I really do kind of obsessively. And, you know, it has to be as good as it can be. And but I'm never looking over my shoulder and thinking like how I'm doing compared to someone else. And it's the same, I think, with, yeah, we're just very collaborative as an organization. We don't compete, we collaborate.
Talking of other institutions, before you joined National Portrait Gallery, you co-curated an exhibition of Henri Matisse's cutout works at Tate Modern. And that was obviously hugely successful. I know it had like over 500,000 visitors, and it really left a big impression on me. I remember the rooms in particular where you see all the large-scale cutout works. Yeah. It was just a mind-blowing show.
Yeah.
Can you talk quickly about Henri Matisse and that, and what it was like being part of that landmark kind of show?
Yeah. Well, actually, that began very, in a very random way, like everything I do. And so I started work at Tate Modern. I was an assistant curator. I started there in 2007, and one of my first shows was to work with Nick Sirota on the Cy Twombly show, which was amazing. And that was in 2008, and the year later
he was still alive then, right? Did you
Cy Twombly? I did a couple of shows with him. I did that one, and then I did one pairing him with Poussin, the 17th century French painter at Dulwich Picture Gallery, in 2011, because Poussin was Cy's favorite artist, basically. Which kind of I always thought was really weird, because they're so opposite, but actually when you look at it, there's the same deep well of inspiration, which is antiquity, landscape, you know, ancient history, sort of classicism, all those things. Anyway, so about 2009, I remember I said to Nick Sirota, like, we should do a Matisse show. Like, you know, at that point, like, Tate Modern had never really done a Matisse show. We'd done like Matisse Picasso, and we'd done several Picasso shows, but there was like a dearth of Matisse. And of course, Tate has the snail, which is, we all love, is amazing. And yeah, and I, you know, as personally, like as a teenager, early teenager, when I was growing up in Yorkshire, I used to, do you remember those like Tartian posters you could buy that were like six little posters in a pack?
Yeah.
And I had Jazz, and I used to have them on my bedroom wall. And that was my idea of like, this is modern art. And I just think there's something so amazing and immediate about those late works by Matisse. They're so moving, but they're so joyful that everyone just kind of gets them. And so, and I said to Nick, we should do the cutouts. And he was like, it's going to be too hard to do. Like, you're not going to get the loans, no. And then a couple of days later, he was like, could you just send in a proposal? And it began like that. And so we started in 2009. And then, yeah, it must have been in, was it 2014? So it took about 5 years.
Wow.
Just to get those loans is really hard. But like, we got almost everything you could possibly want, because we, you know, in talking to all these lenders, they realized this was like a once in a lifetime opportunity. A bit like, I'm going to go see the Vermeer show, actually with Elizabeth Payton in a couple of weeks, at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. And that has something like 80 or 90% of all of his extant works in one place. And, you know, none of us are ever going to see those works all together again. And it was kind of one of those occasions where I don't think Matisse's cutouts will be brought back together at that scale. So it was an amazing show to work with. But it's also kind of how I like to work, which is to, everything I do is really intuitive. Like I don't second guess or focus group or kind of calculate. I really go by my gut instincts and everything. And so it did become this big blockbuster, and we kind of knew it would do probably pretty well because like people like The Cutouts, but we didn't know it was going to like become the number one show, and I think it still is. But yeah, so like
they're good instincts, Nicholas. They're good instincts.
I think it's really cynical to talk about like blockbusters versus like highbrow, or I just don't think that way. I just think about like things I love, to go back to that
storytelling
discussion. Yeah. Like I think it's really boring and cynical to think like we'll do this show because it'll get bums on seats, and then we'll do this show because we really want to do it, but it won't get as many people. Like just do what you love. Like don't worry about it so much, you know? And I think you have to give people credit for their intelligence and curiosity and taste as well.
I'm going to give you some quick fire questions.
Yeah.
Favorite portrait when you were working as a student at the MPG?
Oh, good question. At the MPG?
Yeah.
It probably was that self-portrait by George Romney, because when I was working there was a George Romney show and I spent a lot of time in that show, and I just loved that self-portrait. And actually I put it in the unfinished show at the Met that I mentioned before with Elizabeth Payton, because it is unfinished, and you'll see it's going on view when we reopen in this amazing gallery. Sorry, this is no longer a quick fire. Anyway,
No, it's great. Elaborate.
Yeah.
Favorite portrait apart from mine by Daron Langberg that's coming in from the new 60 that was going to be revealed?
Oh, well, obviously like Mai is quite a special one because that's a really major acquisition. I mean, not just for us, but like for the nation. So that's pretty special. But there's many. I mean, there's so many. Like I'm saying, that there's 60 odd. So
you can't choose a favorite because that would be like really rude.
Well, there's just, you know, there's ones that like really do something different for us. And one thing that's coming in that I'm really excited about because I haven't seen it yet, and it's actually coming in as a loan, but then hopefully we'll acquire it, is an amazing self-portrait by Khadija Say. Which is really beautiful. Wow. And actually there's a color template on the wall where it's going to be hung, and I just can't wait to see that. That's going to be one.
Can you talk about her legacy? Because I mean, it's just tragic.
Yeah. So obviously she was a fantastic artist with you know, really tragically all too brief a career and smaller body of work, because sadly she died in the Grenfell fire. But she left behind these extraordinary photographs, which used kind of 19th century techniques like tintypes and printing techniques, most of which were self-portraits. There's very few of them. And so for us to have that in the collection will be a really amazing thing. And I'm really happy that we got it for the reopening as a loan, but we'll turn it into an acquisition eventually. So
Now we've said it, it's going to be
an acquisition. Yeah, if you build it, it will come. So, I'm really excited for that one.
I think it's incredible. So the £14 million renovation, what was their biggest nightmare in the last 3 years?
Like of that renovation. I mean, it all actually went pretty well. There was no major disasters. I think the probably the hardest thing was like some of the unnecessary friction that was and white noise that was going on, like culture wars, and you know, that was just kind of really boring. I just find it a big distraction. So I mean, hopefully we're kind of getting over that now. But yeah, that's been a little bit of a backdrop, which I found not the most fun thing. But apart, like the actual project, like raising, I mean, there was, you know, stress about raising the money or getting planning permission, but that all
Yeah, because it's
out.
A listed building, right? So there's obviously many restrictions there in place.
Yeah, but it all went really well. We were really lucky. Like, I mean, you know, we got planning permission first time round and everyone could see the benefit of doing this project. And, you know, internally, like there was just lots of, we had challenges, but morale is really good. Like everyone's really excited about this and there's a really good team spirit. And we, you know, it hasn't been fractious or stressful. I just keep saying to people like now, like I did an all-staff briefing on Monday, I'm like, let's just enjoy it. Like everyone's done an amazing job. Things will go wrong. Something won't all be perfect, but let's just make it as good as it can be. But let's really enjoy it. That's one of the most important things, I think.
Yeah.
Your fashion sense is something that's discussed a lot online. I see you as a younger Alan Bennett in style. Would you agree with that?
That is the highest compliment I've ever had. Exactly. Thank you. I will take it. He's from Leeds. Yeah. Great. Yep. Love it. Good. Thank you.
What was the first museum you went to growing up in Yorkshire? You were born in Connecticut, for everyone that's listening anyway, because you're saying you're born in America in 1977, and then you were raised in Yorkshire. What was the first sort of art thing you saw?
My sort of go-to museums were Leeds City Art Gallery and Manchester City Art Gallery, because we lived equidistant between those two. So I would go to those with my mom. I remember, like, when I was about 9, going to see this amazing Corot exhibition, the 19th century French painter, at Manchester City Art Gallery. We would come occasionally to London, but that was like a big treat. We didn't really have the money to do that very often. So yeah, like, those museums made a big impression on me.
And what's been the most wonderful, like, rise against adversity throughout this whole renovation for you?
For the gallery?
Yeah. And personally, I guess.
Oh, good question. Well, it's interesting. Recently, there's been a couple of things where we've been showing people around the almost finished entire projects.
Hard hat.
Yes, hard hat. Yeah, yeah. You actually don't need a hard hat now. That's a sign of progress.
Like, oh, I'd wear one anyway.
And the high vis and the boots.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I felt super butch the last few years putting those on, yeah.
Alan Bennett in a hard hat. Lovely.
I've got a visual image now. It's great. What was interesting is just after all these years of work and, like, overcoming all of these doubts and obstacles, and people said to me, like, oh, we just never thought it was going to happen, or we weren't sure it was going to work. And also, a bit like people said to me, like, you know, we just never thought you were going to pull it off. We didn't think we'd raise the money, I get it, but I don't get it, because I like have an idea and then you just will it into being, and it's just, you make it impossible that it's not going to happen, like manifest destiny. So I just thought it was interesting. Like, I've always had a very clear picture it was going to look like this, and this, like, exactly how everything was going to look, and the wall colors and the labels and the works on the wall, and so it looks exactly like I've always sort of known it would look, if that makes sense. But it's just interesting when you hear, like, people like, oh, we didn't think it was going to happen. And you're like, yeah, anyway, so that, like, it's just that we did it.
This incredible achievement. We cannot wait to get in there.
I can't wait for it. I've actually had so many memorable moments in the National Portrait Gallery since I got into art as well. Like, I remember seeing David Beckham sleeping, and then
not in real life.
No, not in real life.
Yeah, we should have an app.
And even the Bloodhead sculpture by Mark Quinn. Yes. They were all, you know, years and years and years ago. And then Tracy Ehrman's Death Mask bronze sculpture, which I just thought was exquisite.
Well,
and there's so many.
It's funny you mentioned both Mark Quinn's Bloodhead and Tracy Ehrman's Death Mask, because they're both on display. We've done this really beautiful gallery at the end, which looks at life and death masks from our collection, because we have these amazing historical death masks that we don't often show, like of William Blake. And actually, we sell a plaster cast of that in the shop, and that's what inspired, Mark Quinn bought one, and that's what inspired Bloodhead. Francis Bacon bought one in the 60s and made a whole series of paintings around it. And so it's this fantastic dialogue across time, and indeed life and death, of our historical life and death masks, and then contemporary responses, which is really nice. So I'm excited about that.
Mm. So we ask every guest who comes on the show two questions. The first is if you could do an imaginary art heist and take home any work you want from around the world, we can help you with helicopters and vans and trucks. What would you take? But also, what would you take from the National Portrait Gallery collection?
Oh, that's a good one. Shall I start with not MPG first, just in general?
Yeah.
I mean, there's one I really love, which is the Felix Gonzalez Torres, The Two Clocks.
Yes.
Perfect Lovers.
We love
it. Oh, that's such an amazing piece of art. Love it. It's so moving. It's so simple, but it's super moving. So that would be a really nice thing to have. And from the MPG, there's the Gwen John self-portrait, which is pretty amazing. Like, it might have to be that one. But there's a few. Yeah.
I love that one.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah.
Oof. What would you steal to put into the National Portrait Gallery?
Oh, that's even
from somewhere else.
Better question. Oh, I was casing Tate Britain today to figure out what I'm gonna steal, and then I get, yeah, like what do I wish we had, but we don't. Oh, okay, that's a pretty good one. So there's a few that did get away, and one that got away that's pretty amazing is the Holbein of Henry VIII that is now in the Thyssen collection in Madrid. And of course, we have the amazing Holbein drawing cartoon of Henry VII and Henry VIII, which is the only surviving image of the now lost Whitehall painting that was destroyed in the fire of Whitehall.
And they're the preparatory sketches, is that why they're called the cartoons?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Not because it's a Tom and Jerry thing. And that's an amazing thing to have. But yeah, we don't have a great Holbein painting, so I'd probably like to kind of rectify that. And
you got the Ambassadors. Is that not part of the collection?
National Gallery. You know what I should do? I should just break through the wall.
Yes,
and then I can just around the corner.
Yeah.
Is that the National Gallery, the Ambassadors? Right.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get you that.
I think an Art High's tunnel situation is coming up. Yeah.
We will get you
that. Yeah, you need the mole man.
Come help. Yes. Yeah.
Favorite color, Nicholas?
Fabric color?
You can be favorite fabric color as well. Oh, yeah.
That's a Freudian slip. It's funny because the second floor of the gallery are all there's not a painted wall. They're all fabrics, and they're also quite colourful. You'll see. So they're all these wool fabrics, and they're quite rich colours. So there's an orange that I'm pretty obsessed with right now, and you'll see what I mean when we reopen.
Is it a certain type of orange, or we just got to wait and see?
Bright orange.
Lovely.
Yes, that's my favourite
colour. Rob loves that.
Orange is the new black.
I'm going to love the new MPT.
Yeah.
What is the best advice that you've ever received when it comes to your work?
It's not relevant to me, but it's something that Cy Twombly said, and I think about it a lot, and I also say it to artist friends if they're having a bit of a hard time in general. I remember Cy said to me, obviously at this point he was in his early 80s with this incredible career and incredibly successful and incredibly lauded. But he said, the best thing that ever happened to me was when I got kind of forgotten about in the early 60s, especially in America. So, you know, his career really hit the skids in America from the early 60s until the 90s when he had his retrospective at MoMA, because he did a show at Leo Castelli Gallery and it was panned, and especially panned by critics like Donald Judd, the artist. And he said, the best thing that can ever happen to an artist is they get forgotten about for a bit, because you get left alone to make the work that you really want to make. And I think about that a lot, and I think it's so hard for young artists now. They're kind of put on this treadmill of expectation, exploitation, potentially. You know, it can be a very mixed blessing to even have success, I think, right now, because it can also do all kinds of weird things and potentially people try and exploit it. And it's just, so that's something I kind of share with especially the artist friends, that, you know, it's no bad thing to get forgotten about. It's also applicable to all of us. Like, it's been quite nice to be a bit off the radar the last 3 years, it's felt like doing a bit of a PhD again or something, you know, like not be worried about like what reviews are going to say, or, you know, just to be able to kind of get on and do what you want to do.
You're going to have a lot of media and a lot of interviews and a lot of attention, aren't you, in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, let's see. Yeah.
No, he's turning all interviews down. He's only doing talk art.
You've got the exclusive.
Exclusive.
I watched. I just want to say that you taking that advice from Sire, but also I watched a portion of a Vimeo where you were talking to students and giving them advice and inspiration. And you said that one of the most important things is be kind, polite, and courteous, and how you treat others around you, and make sure that other people are enjoying the ride as much as you are. And that feels like something like a manifesto for you, which I assume is what has been galvanizing for all the staff at the MPG and everybody that's really been involved in it.
Yeah, I just think, like, oh my God, let's enjoy it. Like, you know, we all love this, but it's not brain surgery. It's really important. I'm not underestimating it, but, you know, like, no one's going to die, hopefully. Like, we all want to do the best job, but even if like someone says something negative, like, everyone's still going to be alive, so everything's fine. So I just think it's really important I think also, especially like the more senior you are, the more important it is to really set, to kind of set standards and to, I mean, in terms of like behavior and kindness and courtesy, it makes a massive difference. Like, if you, I know that if I walk around the museum and I wouldn't say hello to people or I was scowling, it's going to have a little ripple effect. And yeah, if exactly. I walk around and make sure that I, you know, you don't have to stop and have a long conversation, but if you just make eye contact, smile, say hi to everyone, ask them how they're doing, just like radiate, you know, being human, yeah. it makes a massive difference.
That's a brilliant way to finish, yeah.
yeah. Yeah, just putting people at ease, you know, it's like really, it's a really simple thing to do. It doesn't cost anything. It also makes life much more enjoyable for you. And yeah, I just think we should enjoy it. You know, we should just enjoy life and we should enjoy what we're doing. It's like we get to do something kind of amazing and not everyone gets to do that. So let's enjoy it, you know.
Well, we have enjoyed this last hour and a bit with you, Nicholas. Thank you so, so much for coming on Talk Art. We are all so excited. What is the actual opening date? June the
22nd.
June the 22nd.
Less than a month.
And then it's open. It's not shutting down again.
Yeah, but also there's so many cool shows coming up. So there's an amazing kind of first look festival for a week or so. But then you have Paul McCartney's photographs from 1963 Ooh. To 1964, which is a really fascinating year for him.
I have to say, we're installing that show now and it is really blowing my mind. And it's incredibly moving because there's hundreds of photographs that have never been seen by the world. And they're so intimate and they're so kind of tender and poignant. I just saw yesterday, I don't think I'm giving anything away, but I just saw these two photographs that he took in that year of John Lennon wearing glasses, like really thick glasses. And I don't think the world kind of knew that at that point, like John Lennon probably needed to wear glasses all the time. And I just found it really moving. So yeah, I'm kind of excited about that show.
That's your Specsavers history.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
I just saw Mary McCartney's show and the portraits of her mum's bed.
Yeah.
I love that portrait, that picture. It's such a beautiful, beautiful photo. Yeah, and you also have, how do you say it?
Yvonne's, yeah. The artist formerly known as Madame Yvonne's.
Madame Yvonne.
She was this amazing British photographer, pioneer of colour photography, active from the 1920s until like the 70s. And we had a great collection of her work. And then 2 or 3 years ago, we acquired her entire archive of photographic negatives. And actually the Chanel project, they sort of funded us being able to do all this research and to print these images, which had never really been properly printed before. And it's a revelation. She's such an amazing photographer. She looks so contemporary in her sitters, her subjects, her colors, the setup. Yeah, that's a great show too.
Yeah, the use of colour is incredible.
Yep.
And also, I'm really excited for the Taylor Wessing Photo Portrait Prize, which is at the end of the year, because that's obviously like new portraits, new life, and super, super exciting new talents. So I can't wait for that.
Yeah, like Echo Show that he's doing early next year, which is called The Time Is Always Now.
Echo Ishan. I love him.
The final show that we've, because we announced the first year of programme, the final show is going to be really amazing, which is Julia Margaret Cameron with Francesca Woodman, that pairing, which looks incredible.
Yes. Yeah.
And then more to come, but I can't say.
Well, thank you so much. It's been such a privilege and honor to spend this hour with you. And for everyone listening, the podcast I mentioned earlier about the poet who was talking about paying attention, he's a poet called David White, and it was with Krista Tippett, and it's on Being. I really recommend that episode. It is extraordinary, from May 2022. And then head over to the National Portrait Gallery. It opens from the 22nd of June 2023. So much of the National Portrait Gallery is free to access. The new entrance, the new install, the new hang is remarkable, and I think it's going to really bring something wonderful to this country, including the portrait of Russell Tovey by the one and only Daron Langberg. And you can also hear our episode with Daron Langberg on the archives of Talk Art. So dig in and you can learn more about his world as well. Well, thank you so much for listening.
Thank you, Nicholas.
We'll
thank you, everyone.
Very soon.
Thank you both for having me. It's been great.
Thank you, Nicholas. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.